This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. Problems like old hospital buildings, outdated healthcare equipment or health facilities that are simply too few and far between, whether we hear it from others or have experienced it ourselves, it's not uncommon to hear about such stories when it comes to our public health system, especially in rural and underserved areas. But we know that healthcare resources are limited. So to what extent is it possible to, well, replace the old with the new, in a sense? And how would this affect quality of care for patients? In our third episode of our Mind the Health Gap series, we're looking at this problem of public health infrastructure. Where are the gaps and what do we need to prioritize? With my guests, Agnes Padan, rural health activist, as well as Dr. Kaur Swee King, independent health policy specialist. And they will be bringing their different expertise and perspectives together, you know, from the bigger picture right to the community's lived experience and challenges. Thank you so much to the both of you for joining me today. Swee King, I want to start with you first, only to set the stage so that we are familiar with sort of some terms and references that we will probably be going on to discuss. But when we talk about physical infrastructure, one might think, okay, hospitals, brick and mortar kind of buildings, but what exactly does physical infrastructure cover, and what is, you know, how important is it in the delivery of healthcare services to every single person living in Malaysia?
It's a pleasure to be here, especially with my friend Agnes, somebody I deeply admire and respect, to speak about something that's very important to every part of Malaysia, and that is the physical infrastructure of our healthcare system. Shawik, your question is, what is physical infrastructure? Can I try to begin with a little bit of poetry and philosophy? And the poetry and philosophy is to say that the physical infrastructure of a hospital or a clinic is how the average Malaysian citizen experiences the government of Malaysia's services. In other words, the government of Malaysia exists in a physical entity every time we have 145 hospitals and people visit 145 hospitals, or the 2,000 clinic kesihatans around Malaysia, or another 1,500 clinic desas around Malaysia. That is the physical infrastructure of our healthcare system. But that physical infrastructure is actually the manifestation of a state of the government of Malaysia. Our tax dollars go into the physical infrastructure, the hospitals and the clinics that we see. But our physical infrastructure is not just hospitals and clinics. It is also the ambulances and the additional services that are inside it. And inside the hospitals and the clinics are, you can see the ambulances that take somebody from your home to a dialysis center. But inside the hospital, you will also see beds. That is also a physical infrastructure. You also need to see ventilators that help you breathe in an intensive care unit. That's also an infrastructure. And every part of the hospital, for example, the kitchen is infrastructure. The machine for you to clean and sanitize clothes is infrastructure. X-ray machines and MRI machines and all that are also infrastructure. And the physical infrastructure is not just buildings, it's what's inside of those buildings. And finally, Xiaoyik, it is not just a physical building, but also what's inside those buildings. And I've given examples like the MRI machine. The third and final infrastructure that we need to consider is the digital infrastructure. We don't see it because of 5G and wireless, but we need telecommunications towers, especially in the interior parts of Malaysia. And that telecommunications towers for 5G and Wi-Fi and all that needs to be backed up with water as well as electricity generation and so on and so forth. So that's just the physical infrastructure for our healthcare system in Malaysia.
Yeah. So what it really sounds like is many pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. And without one of those or several of those pieces, the system can't work as it should. People can't experience healthcare and avail of services as they should. But perhaps we can turn to Agnes for a more on-the-ground look instead of trying to understand it conceptually. Agnes, I think from your years of work, and especially where it relates to the state of Sarawak and Lawas, where you're from, how would you describe the state of existing public healthcare facilities?
And thank you. I would like to say thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak on behalf of, especially for the Lawas of the people of Lawas. I've been here in Lawas for more than 3 years now. And during the pandemic, MCO, it was very difficult for us to get healthcare services for, especially for cancer patients, kidney patients, and patients who are struggling with infectious disease like TB. This is mainly due to a lack of facilities, specialists, and the hospital itself. We are also struggling in Lawas because patients will have to travel quite a distance to access proper healthcare. Lawas is, and as we all know, Lawas is surrounded by three borders, which is Sabah, Brunei, and also Kalimantan. During MCO, it is almost impossible for patients to travel to KK Queen Elizabeth or Likas Hospital for a treatment. Brunei border is closed. Unless if it's emergency, then the patients will be sent by ambulance. Otherwise, the other option is to take a flight to Miri, but not many people can afford it. After MCO, now some cancer patients like Mebung, if you ever heard of Mebung or you read article about Mebung, she's been referred to Likas Hospital for follow-up treatment. And it takes 3 hours drive from Lawas to Likas Hospital. Services like CT scan, MRI, not available in Lawas. Patient will have to travel to Limbang or Miri. These are just some of the issues with the current healthcare system here in Lawas.
Yeah. Again, I guess, you know, you speak best from the Lawas community's perspective. And if we talk about having to travel 3 hours, and that would be the nearest and sort of quote-unquote easiest journey to make, what do people access when they arrive at Likas? What kind of healthcare facility and what kind of services are available there?
Okay, for example, Likas Hospital is a cancer specialist, okay? So it's nearer for us from Lawas to travel to Likas Hospital. So if a cancer patient to be sent to Miri, the patient will have to go by land, which will take you 5 hours journey, or else you can take flight, but it will cost you a lot more than by land. Otherwise, you will have other option, which to go to Kuching Hospital, and that will a lot more further, which is from Lawas to Kuching. It will take 1,200 kilometer, so that is the struggle that we have to go through.
Mm. So when it comes to accessing the really basic kind of things, our maternal care, right, for pregnant mothers, go for checkups, like you said, follow-up care for kidney conditions, perhaps diabetes and things like that. What options do people in the community have?
Usually for a complicated pregnancy, the mother will be sent to Limbang.
Okay.
Yeah, right. Because in Lawas, we do not have a specialist station here.
Mm-hmm. All right. What about mothers who perhaps don't have complicated pregnancies? What is their typical routine care like?
It's the distance. So for the mothers from the Ulu, they will have to go by four-wheel drive, and the journey will take at least 4 hours from the Ulu to the nearest hospital, which is Hospital District Lawas Hospital. So I think that will also involve the mom's safety itself with pregnancy, you know. And it's not safe for the mom to travel, you know, that kind of a journey and the distance itself. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, for anyone who's not familiar, the kind of journey on four-wheel drive that Agnes is describing is not even on paved roads. It's often on logging roads, very, very bumpy, can be very, very dangerous as well. And Agnes, just one last point for now. SK talked about digital infrastructure also being very important when we talk about the healthcare system. Mm-hmm. And digital infrastructure depends on even more basic essential services like electricity. So what are things looking like in Lawas in that sense?
Based on my own experience, I'm staying in Lawas town itself, you know, and sometimes my internet coverage is not very good. And what more to say about those who stays in Ulu and the internet coverage is very, very bad. Sometimes they don't get coverage at all. And I have a family I met yesterday. They are living like 40 minutes away from Lawas town itself. And the roads condition to their village are quite okay. But the internet coverage also, they're having some issue with it. Yeah, that's up to today.
All right. What about really basic services like water and electricity? What is it looking like for Lawas as well as in the Ulu areas?
Mostly the community who lives in the Ulu, they're depending on solar. And water supply is from the mountain, you know. And the community who lives nearby Lawas, which I can say about 30 minutes away from the Lawas town, they are having an issue with their water supply itself, clean water supply, I mean. Yeah.
Mm, yep. SK, would you like to jump in here and I guess help us to broaden the lens, because we've been able to look at it from the experience of one rural community in Sarawak. And of course, we don't want to generalize it to other rural areas in Sabah and Sarawak, because each area and each community has their own very unique challenges. But if we were to look at the state of healthcare facilities, that physical infrastructure that you described across the country, what are the main gaps that you've identified?
To have a more macro lens of what are the gaps, we probably need some information which is not easily available publicly. Some pieces of information that we need are, number one, what is the average coverage or rather the bed to population ratio? In other words, for every 1,000 population or 1,000 Malaysians living in a particular district or town, how many hospital beds are available to them? But it's not just the physical hospital bed. We can also measure access in terms of how many percent of Malaysians live within 5 kilometers or 3 kilometers or 1 kilometer of a health facility. This number will tell us how quickly it is easy for the person to physically access a healthcare facility. A third metric will be to look at what is the waiting time. Meaning, if I need emergency treatment for, example, childbirth or cancer, do I wait 5 minutes or do I wait 5 hours or 5 days, for example? Of course, that last metric of waiting time depends not only on the physical infrastructure, but it also depends on the number of doctors, number of nurses, number of paramedics, and so on. But these are three examples, shall we, about how we can measure the adequacy of physical infrastructure. Another way to measure the adequacy of a physical infrastructure is to look at the subjective elements of physical infrastructure. So I've given three objective numbers, for example, how many beds per population or what's the waiting time. But a subjective measure would be how old is the infrastructure? I mean, you may have a clinic, but the clinic's 50 years old and we've not refurbished or renovated the clinic, the roof's always leaking, the water supply is not great, electricity is only 4 hours a day, for example. And these are more subjective measures about the quality of the physical infrastructure. And I think, Shawik, when we combine these two pieces of information, we can see that there would be inevitably some gaps in a country like Malaysia. The gaps would be, number one, we don't have enough physical infrastructure. And number two, whatever we have is not adequately maintained. These are the two main structural problems or gaps, really, in Malaysia's physical infra. We don't have enough. And number two, whatever we have is not properly maintained. To solve this problem requires more systemic solutions, but notably, two important strategies. The first strategy is adequate funding. The second strategy is adequate governance for that funding. It's not enough that you have a lot of money being put into the health system if that money is not properly controlled. No corruption, wastage, fraud, abuse, cronies, and so on and so forth. That will be a challenge for the system. So to solve the problem, we need enough money, but we also need enough governance for that money.
All right. We'll come back and continue this conversation. I'm speaking to Agnes Padan, rural health activist, as well as Dr. Kaur Swee King, independent health policy specialist. It's the third episode of our Mind the Health Gap series, where we've been, in previous episodes discussing various challenges and issues when it comes to the big umbrella theme of access to healthcare. Today, we're talking about access to physical public health infrastructure. Whether Malaysians have healthcare facilities within their reach. Is the healthcare facility able to meet their needs when it comes to providing healthcare services? Many other issues related to that as well. So stay tuned to Health and Living on BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. Joining me via Zoom today, Agnes Padan, rural health activist, joining from Sarawak, and Dr. Kaur Swee King, independent health policy specialist. It's the third episode of our Mind the Health Gap series. And we're looking at, if we're talking about the adequacy of our public health infrastructure, in terms of the physical infrastructure, brick and mortar buildings, healthcare equipment, vehicles to serve the healthcare system, for instance, ambulances, even digital infrastructure. Lots of different elements required to ensure that physical infrastructure is adequate and adequately maintained as well in order to serve people living in Malaysia. Just a point that I want to quickly follow up on, SK. You talked about gaps. If we look across the country, the macro view of the state of our healthcare facilities, immediately I think we can see that the gaps are not enough and not adequately maintained, especially in some underserved areas. Would the experience of accessing healthcare also include the ease of navigating the system, SK? And how do we fare there in terms of, does the physical infrastructure, and I think we've heard from Agnes already, the very fact that you need to travel long distances, arduous journeys to access a clinic or a hospital, a district hospital. But when you're in the hospital, and this can be said of many large general hospitals, that it can be very challenging for patients to know where to go, that they have to go from one clinic to another at the other end of the hospital, wait for a long time for imaging, x-rays and things like that. That's just a very limited example. But how much of that should also be considered when we look at physical infrastructure?
So this is an excellent question that requires a lot of input from diverse groups, for example, an architect, and the building maintenance engineer, and people who are actually involved in designing the clinical care pathways. In other words, more than just doctors alone. So we need architects, building managers, and so on to help improve the patient experience. Let me provide three adjectives to describe what I think is at least the minimum requirement for a good patient experience inside a physical facility, like a hospital or a clinic. Number one, the hospital or the clinic has to be safe. Number two, the hospital or clinic has to be comfortable. Number three, the hospital or clinic has to be easy to use. Therefore, safe, comfortable, and easy to use, perhaps even in that order. So let's start with safe. What I mean by safe is there's no roof leaking water. There are no puddles of water to make it slippery for you. There should be enough lighting so that you don't slip and fall. Hospitals should not catch fire. For example, some hospitals in Malaysia have caught fire before due to poor fire prevention practices. And in the era of COVID, where people are now seeing hospitals as being unsafe, why? Because you can get infections in a hospital, right? Then we must change, or the government of Malaysia must change the perception that hospitals and clinics are unsafe. Therefore, the first requirement for a hospital or a clinic, the physical hospital or the physical clinic, is it has to be safe. no leakages, no puddles, no slippery floors, enough lighting, enough ventilation, low risk of infection. That is the first requirement. You meet that requirement, you get to the second requirement, which is comfortable. Now, comfortable doesn't mean luxury. You don't need air conditioners and leather seats, for example. But as long as the hospital is comfortable, meaning it is clean, it is green, there are lots of flowers and trees, and it's in a quiet environment, not next to a busy bus station, for example, and it's a comfortable environment for patients to recover when they are warded, or feeling comfortable for people to attend, that it's not too warm or too cold, and the air is clean and things like that. So the second requirement is really for it to be comfortable. And thirdly and finally, easy to use. For example, as the population of Malaysia ages, now 7% of our population is above the age of 60. That's a high percentage and it's going to go higher and higher. We don't want a 70-year-old or an 80-year-old literally walk 1 kilometer inside the corridors of a hospital to move from one department in order to get an x-ray and then walk another kilometer to go back to the department to see the doctor. Therefore, can we put the x-ray department right next to the clinic, for example, so that we can make it easy for patients to use? So, Sherry, I just provided three guiding principles for how the healthcare facility for a patient should look like. Number one, it needs to be safe. Number two, it needs to be comfortable. And then number three, it needs to be very easy to use.
Mm. You've described my ideal experience if I need to interact with the healthcare system. But Agnes, I would like to turn to you now. And when we look at whether we have adequate healthcare facilities, we do have to look at this so-called sick hospital problem. Both Sarawak and Sabah have had several hospitals that were supposed to be built and have been just sort of put on hold, in construction, problems with tender and contractors for many years. And the new Lawas District Hospital is one of those that has been delayed as well. When we look at these kinds of problems, what challenges is it then presenting to the communities, right? And how important is it to have them up and running yesterday as soon as possible?
Accessibility to a good healthcare system is our biggest concern. And the current 44-bedded Lawas District Hospital is also now too congested and too small to house any specialist center or facilities. Again, in 1996, seven mission plan. The new Lawas District Hospital was approved, and again, 2011, they approved 121.6 million for the construction of the Lawas District Hospital. But we don't know what happened to that budget because the hospital was never built. And 2019, 165 million again was allocated for the construction. The Lawas District Hospital, as of today, we see only less than 10% work completed. Construction supposed to be complete beginning of 2024. And with this huge budget for 76-bedded hospital, it is certainly taking such a long, long time to construct. And as we see today, how many times they have planned to build this Lawas District Hospital, but up to today, we don't see any building yet so far.
And when it comes to how it's affecting individuals, are people being turned away from the current hospital, Agnes, simply because they can't accommodate?
I can answer you on that, which is my father himself. So he was not well since before Sarawak election, the recently election, okay? So what happened? He came back to Lawas and he was here in Lawas with me, and he was admitted several times in Lawas District Hospital, so with the current hospital. So he was complaining of his leg pain, abdomen, back pain, and, name it, it's all there. So he is struggling. So I took him to the Lawas Hospital and they could not diagnose. But he had severe constipation for weeks. He was treated for constipation at Lawas Hospital. And we noticed that he was losing muscle, and he was admitted at Lawas Hospital several times. Finally, he got an appointment visiting weeks specialist, but we have to wait for 2 weeks. My sister, who is a qualified staff nurse in Kuala Lumpur, so after consulting her, we decided to send my father to Kuala Lumpur. He was then admitted to Shah Alam Hospital. They check on him immediately. They diagnose him with lymphoma cancer. Immediately took tissue sample for them to identify type of lymphoma. While waiting for the result from the sample, which will take about 2 weeks, he was given a painkiller. His health was getting worse and very, very weak. So immediately my sister rushed him to cancer specialist center in PJ. So immediately did a CT scan and took a sample, and within 48 hours, they managed to identify the type of lymphoma. And this cancer was actually very active and spreading very quickly. And Wigan Hospital gave the right treatment to stop the cancer from spreading. And within 2 weeks, he was referred to Klang Hospital for chemotherapy. And after first cycle of chemo, we decided to bring him back to Miri, where one of my brother is staying, and he is now being treated in Miri Hospital. So this was happened to my family, and we just don't know what will happen to a family who don't have contacts, family who can't afford to go to Kuala Lumpur, Miri, or wherever. They will have to struggle in pain. They have to suffer in silence. So this is what we are facing, the community from Lawas, actually, yeah.
So, yeah, I think what you've described is really everyone in your family just trying to figure out a different path. And that's really because of your own resources and initiative. You're right. Communities, far more vulnerable families may not have that privilege in that sense. SK, how... And one could look at that story and say, well, there are these different hospitals that they can go to. There are options, quote unquote. But how do we get to this point that it takes so much on a family to seek healthcare for a father's cancer, for instance?
That's a difficult question to answer, shall we? Because that answer to that question is beyond just health, and it must include things like, What are our national priorities in Malaysia? How do we pay for healthcare, including how much taxes do we collect? Thirdly, how do we organize our society so that we can remove the non-physical barriers to access? This conversation that we're having today is about physical infrastructure, right? So I'll make a comment there, and then I'll move on to the non-physical infrastructure, which is as important, because we can build beautiful hospitals as we have. Politicians love the act of officiating new hospitals. But the soft infrastructure or the non-physical infrastructure is as important as the physical infrastructure. So what I might say is that the physical infrastructure is actually very important. We have to begin there, but then we have to continue other things. And I'll give, unfortunately, a very sad statistic. The sad statistic is that there are more CT scans and MRI machines in all of Kuala Lumpur compared to Sabah and Sarawak combined. Sabah and Sarawak have the fewest number of CT scans and MRI machines compared to other parts of Malaysia. In fact, Sabah, which is the furthest state away from, say, Kuala Lumpur, because you have to fly for about 2.5 hours to get to Kota Kinabalu, Sabah only recently managed to purchase their first PET scan, PET scan. It's one of the more advanced imaging machines that we have. And that is in the, both the public and private sectors. And the first PET scan is only going to be available in Sabah very soon. The point being that if anybody needs a PET scan in Sabah, they'll actually have to fly to Kuala Lumpur or wherever in Peninsula Malaysia to receive a PET scan before they go back to Sabah to receive any treatment. And that physical infrastructure, we need to solve that problem. But let me set aside the physical infra problem and talk about the non-physical infra in two ways. The first way of non-physical is the doctors, nurses, technicians, specialists, and human capital, meaning the human beings who are managing the physical infra. It's not just enough that we build a beautiful hospital, but we don't staff it with enough doctors and specialists and nurses. So we need a human capital infrastructure too. And secondly, it's the financial infrastructure. which is to Agnes's story and then also to your question, shall we? There are these non-physical financial access barriers to healthcare. You may have a beautiful hospital with lots of doctors, but you don't have the money to pay for it. And when I say don't have the money to pay for it, this is not necessarily only in the private sector, you know, but it's also in the government sector. Although healthcare is subsidized in the government sector, this is true. You pay 1 ringgit or 5 ringgit, you see a specialist, but you are also requested to pay for things which are not covered by the 1 ringgit and 5 ringgit. For example, you need a hip implant or a knee replacement, that 6,000 ringgit, 20,000 ringgit maybe, that you have to pay. You have a heart attack and you need a stent, you have to pay for the stent as well. So even if you go to the public hospitals, you're still having financial access problems. So shall we, all this is to say that we probably have to resolve not only the physical infra, but also the human capital infra, and finally the financial architecture, so that nobody who needs healthcare ever has to go bankrupt, for example, or pay too much in order to access that healthcare.
Agnes, from your community's perspective, tell me a little bit more about what kind of financial barriers they face. And like SK said, it's not just about what you have to pay for that outpatient care. A lot of other expenses and costs come into it that a family has to consider when for, let's say, a mother to go for her pregnancy checkups, right? Or somebody's cancer checkup as well.
I think the question that I truly understand her struggle, she's struggle in financially, so which is mobung, and she's in her 60s, and the husband is also quite elderly, and she herself, she's not working, so she's depending on the husband. When I first met her, she was complaining about, you know, in 2017, she finds out that her right breast having she was having a lump on her right breast, but she is also worried about the expenses and all that. And because she doesn't have document at all, so she's a stateless mom. So she decided to to suffer in silence. So she did not go for any checkup. So as a person without a citizenship, as you go to a government hospital, the charges are a lot more. I'm not talking about a lot more. It's for her to go if she's having fever or flu and so on. She has to pay 50 ringgit just for that. But what more to say if she's a cancer patient? So the charges is like crazy, So what I did was, I ran through all of her document just to support her. So I work on it very, very hard. So I got her to Lawas Hospital. I said, don't worry about anything at all. Actually, I'm also worried and how am I going to settle her bill or whatsoever it is. It will take later after that. So I told her, don't worry about anything. So I took her to hospital and I showed the doctor the pictures, her condition and everything else. I explained and then they immediately took her in. They checked on her and then they fixed an appointment to see a specialist the next day. So I took her, the next day I took her again to see the specialist. So we discussed anything and everything. So the doctor agreed. I said, okay, Agnes, we'll send her to Miri to see again the specialist. And I said, I need help on her, how she's going to travel to Miri. And she can't afford, the flight. She can't afford even to take a transport by herself also. She can't afford it. So, and I discussed with the doctor. I said, if you are willing to help, please send her by ambulance and bring her back also by ambulance. I just need that help. So the doctor agreed. So we fixed appointment to Limbang. She went by ambulance, came back by ambulance. Miri twice, ambulance brought her there and bring her back as well. So, I just try my best. So it's like me begging to the hospital and to the whoever doctor who is treating her, to help her just to ease her burden as a cancer patient. So now she has done her surgery and now she's going for her chemo, and so I'm just happy to do it.
That's a great story, Agnes. Thank you so much for sharing that. But, you know, SK, we only have one Agnes, unfortunately, who champions people in her community so tirelessly. So if we want to look at improving our physical infrastructure of the healthcare system, you know, more systemically, looking beyond what single people like Agnes can do, what can we realistically achieve? What should we prioritize?
This is a difficult question to answer. What else we can do is perhaps a few things beyond just the individual. Now, the individual is extremely important, and we can see how powerful and a personality like Agnes has been in advocating for better facilities in Lawas, in Sarawak, and just throughout Malaysia. But other things that we can do at the same time, which is not to replace the individual, but to augment the individual, to amplify the individual's work, are perhaps as follows. Firstly, mobilize. In other words, we need to organize and come together and form societies, pressure groups, lobby groups, and just to become a more powerful voice. And people like Agnes will be able to provide moral and also organizational leadership for such attempts to organize, mobilize into patients, societies, and so on and so forth, so that we're able to advocate stronger. I think this is one thing that we can do. The individual is powerful. We're also as powerful if we work together. This is one. Number two, I think Malaysia and Malaysians, the individual Malaysians, right? We should make it a habit to write more frequently to our members of parliament. In other words, advocate for our respective neighborhoods and villages and towns and cities and locations with the members of parliament who are representing us in parliament. Therefore, if we write enough letters, we make enough requests, we in fact make enough demands, really, because this is our right as a Malaysian citizen to demand for better healthcare. And I think this is the second thing that we can do, appropriately lobby our members of parliament. The third thing that we can do is join the political process, write letters to the editor, voice your frustrations and your requests out on social media, and to be able to participate in the public discourse surrounding this. Now, these are what the individuals can do. Collectively, as a sum total, imagine if we had 32 million Agneses all operating at even 10% of what Agnes is doing right now. I think that this will be a very powerful national wave towards more investment in healthcare. Ultimately, it is a matter of political will. And if we mobilize politically, we will be able to create enough political will, because health is a political choice. Health is only 50% science, really. Science, evidence, clinical trials, and so on is definitely needed and very important, but that's 50%. And the remaining 50% requires us to make good political choices, which includes things like appropriate and adequate investment in our health. Finally, is to end with a more philosophical note to say that health is not a cost center, it's an investment. If you invest in healthcare facilities, you're actually creating jobs, because people have to build those hospitals. Then people have to maintain those hospitals, and that's job creation. You stimulate the economy, you increase the health of the population, you bring them into the country of Malaysia, and you bring all Malaysians into society. And all that has got very positive long-term implications. Health is not a cost. Health is an investment. And this can start with us individuals being very mindful about our power and to be really, inspired by people like Agnes.
Agnes, I'm sure you have not been silent when it comes to advocating or lobbying to your MP or to your ADUN, perhaps. What would you like them to do to serve the community, to improve the healthcare system?
I've been, you know, they might feel, you know, fed up with me every time I post something about the issue here, especially the Lawas, because Lawas community, I always take, you know, the Minister of Health, I always take the, you know, now I'm talking also about the statelessness issue in Lawas. So I always take whoever is in that line. So, I do hope that they follow my Facebook and they read the issue and then they follow the issue and do something about it and be vocal about the issue. You know, by you keeping quiet, we voted for you to be our voice, to be our representative, but you keeping quiet and things are not going to resolve, you know, and you already someone up there that we are really hoping that you will be our voice to resolve our issue. But if you're not doing it, then who else going to do it, you know? And I'm just one person, you know, just a small lady here trying to voice out. But I don't know how far can I go. I'm not sure. But here I'm almost every day, you know, screaming about the issue. So even though it's not related to me, but, you know, I feel bad for the community, you know, and especially if the this family is from the B40 group family, and I feel really bad if I can't help them. And the only thing I can do now, I just voice out and I call the media. I try and make a statement. That's all can I do for now. But the representative, the MP or the YBs, they can do lots more.
SK, you talked earlier about two main solutions if we want to improve our physical infrastructure, adequate funding and adequate governance of that funding. Can you talk a little bit, you know, when it comes to adequate funding, how much is adequate? How much is ever enough? And I know you've said before that it's not about, you never want to answer that question. It's not about, you know, putting a number to it and then like, putting our money in the kitty for that. So how do we go about achieving this?
It remains as difficult a question as the previous times when we tried to address the question of how much is enough. And the answer is, I guess, more philosophically, nothing is ever going to be enough for healthcare. However, it's important for us to have adequate, but not too much. Whatever is too much, and we will have different opinions about what is enough and what is too much. Let me set that aside and talk about some real numbers. Malaysia at the moment spends 4% of our GDP or gross domestic product on healthcare. Approximately half of that is public, meaning Ministry of Health, and half of that is in the private. So it's 4% of health GDP on healthcare. And this is low. How do we say it's low? We compare this against a basket of peer countries. The global average is 10%. So the average country spends 10% of their GDP on health. In European countries or rich countries like the OECD or Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development countries, OECD countries, the average is 10 to 11%. Now, Singapore spends 4%. But Singapore spends 4% of a higher number because your GDP is greater and they get better outcomes than us as well. So this is one metric to see that Malaysia is spending less than the average country around the world, but spending itself is perhaps as important as how you govern the spending. The spending in Singapore is 4%. So if we measure Malaysia to Singapore, we're also spending 4% each, but their outcomes appear to be better because they're spending the money more efficiently. So therefore, what we can say is that Malaysia has the space to increase from perhaps 4% to 6 to 8% of GDP over the next 3 to 5 years. It should not be a sudden increase. If the Malaysian government puts in 50% more money overnight, meaning from budget 2021 to budget 2022, there's a 50% increase, that money will be probably not spent well. Why? Because our procurement mechanisms and our way of spending money is not well governed. So it's like putting a lot more money into a leaky pipe that will then leak a lot of that money out. So it's important that although we increase the funding and we can increase through a formula, for example, 10% increase every year for the next 5 years to achieve a target of 6% of GDP. Now, I'm inventing some numbers which I think are reasonable, but these numbers have to be debated in the Dewan Rakyat. However, the point being, we can increase from 4% to around 6 to 8%, but we must do this gradually, not overnight. And we can do this through a locked-in formula of a 10% increase, for example, every year for the next 3 to 5 years. And that's one way to increase, and that will probably make it better investments in healthcare for us. Shall we? That's the first part. The second part is easy, which is we need to govern the money better. I mean, easy to say, but difficult to do. However, Malaysia's got a pretty reasonable infrastructure for procurement. Now, we have to make sure that we expand the infrastructure and make sure that we actually implement the infrastructure. On paper, we've got beautiful procurement policies and separation between federal and state and at the local level, at the hospital level. We have all these things on paper. Now, we have to enforce that appropriately to ensure that whenever you are actually making the decision to procure, that this is the best contract that we can get and not a contract that's given over to a crony or through direct negotiations and no corruption, wastage, fraud and abuse. to repeat, Malaysia's got the reasonable procurement infrastructure at the moment. Now, what's lacking is the implementation and the enforcement portions of it. It exists on paper. Now we have to put it into reality. Now, if you couple both of this together, a planned increase in our healthcare funding in the private side, in the public side, I apologize, coupled together with excellent implementation of our existing procurement and governance systems, I think that we'll be able to get good outcomes. It's not just the money, it's how you spend it.
Mm. So I think this leads nicely to a question that I'd like to use to wrap up our conversation. Minister of Health, KJ, has talked about putting together a white paper on health reforms to be tabled nearer to the end of the year. So I think all of these different conversations, we hope, will be part of that white paper. So, you know, we can't just talk about what we want in isolation, as mere yearnings. We want the government to take heed of whatever the challenges are and to look at structures that can fix the problems. So if I were to ask you, what is your wish list, Agnes, for this white paper on health reform? What would you put there?
I would love to ask from whoever it's concerned, so for them to equip all clinics in the Ulu with good facilities and competent staff, you know. And the furthest village in the district of Lawas is Baklalan, so which is 177 kilometers away by land. And in the event of any complication, clinic in the Ulu must be equipped and competent to manage the situation. For example, if a mother comes in with a postpartum hemorrhage, they must treat the mother with great urgency. And the flight to Baklalan is only 3 times a week. And Lawas to Kuching is very far, which is 1,200 kilometers. And it is important, the new District Lawas Hospital, to have a specialist center where we could manage patients with cancer, for example, follow-up treatment. They don't need to go to Miri, Kuching, or Likas for their follow-up. And a proper maternal health care system, better facilities for kidney patients, and, you know, infectious disease like TB to be properly managed, control, better facilities like CT scan, and also a proper X-ray. So it's quite a long list for us in Lawas.
But a lot of things that, for instance, I think an urban community in the Klang Valley over here in Peninsula Malaysia that we take for granted. And it's very sobering to know that there are communities that still need to ask for these kinds of facilities. SK, what are your thoughts? What should be on this white paper?
This will probably be the white paper number 15 or 18 in the last 40 years or so. Every health minister who comes in, and we change the health minister every 3 years on average in Malaysia, has a white paper or at least a plan for the health reforms of Malaysia. We need a white paper. We need reforms for Malaysia. That much is certain. So I look forward to two things from this particular white paper to succeed where all the previous ones have failed. Firstly, ambitiousness, and secondly, execution. Ambitiousness in the sense that we need to be ambitious, that white papers by nature cannot only be incremental improvements within the system. So in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years time, we need to redesign and reimagine what health looks like for Malaysia. So I hope that it is ambitious, that it is long-term, even idealistic, if I can use that word, but in the short term, very pragmatic about what it needs to do. So my first request or hope or expectation for the white paper is ambitiousness. But ambitiousness is nothing without the second, which is execution. It's just easy to put a lot of stuff on paper to say this and that, and we want a world-class health system, etc. But the execution is important. And execution requires two things. One, political will. And number two, political skill. Political will requires individual citizens to come in and say, we want health and we want health now. And I think this minister and this Ministry of Health understands that there is enough political will. But not only political will, we need skill. Because health, if you try to reform health, there'll be winners and losers. The losers will try to resist, obviously. And we need to find a way to make the losers not feel that they've lost. We need to find ways to get people who are outside the Ministry of Health. you want to reform the health system, it's not just the Ministry of Health. It's also the Ministry of Finance, Treasury, Economic Planning Unit, International Trade Industry, Bank Negara, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it's not just as simple as we want reforms and the Ministry of Health will reform itself, but that's not enough because we need other ministries as well. So all this is to say, Shawika, I hope and expect for two things. One, ambitiousness of the white paper, and number two, high quality execution.
All right. Thank you so much. This has been a very robust conversation about what we need to keep our eye on when it comes to improving our physical health infrastructure, especially our public health infrastructure. This has been the third episode of our Mind the Health Gap series, together with Agnes Padan, rural health activist, and Dr. Kaur Swee King, independent health policy specialist. You've been listening to Health and Living, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.